Okay, hello everybody. Welcome to lecture three. I'm sorry I couldn't give the lecture at the regularly scheduled time Tuesday because I was in on a plane at that time back from the Mises Institute. I saw at least one person who's taking this course at the conference. It was a very nice conference, and I got to see some very good people, including Danny Sanchez and his wife and baby. There was a very good episode with the baby, but I'm not going to say what that was. Now, today we're going to cover a topic that I think it's very important that we understand the historical background that human action was composed in. Remember, the book was published, of course, in 1949, but Mises really, it wasn't a translation of his book that had come out around 1940, Nacional Economy. It was an expansion and recasting that book. But it was a very similar book, and that book Mises had been working on in the 1930s. So it's very important, I think, in understanding what's going on in these pages to bear that in mind. And we'll see why that's the case in a few minutes. Okay, now one thing that's become, I think, very obvious in the lecture so far is that Mises is what Joe Salerno calls a social rationalist. He thinks that the reason people form societies is that they see the advantages to doing so. You're much better off if you are together with other people instead of trying to produce everything for yourself. You can specialize and take advantage of a division of labor. And last week, we saw that division of labor will and trade will work even for people who are not very good at producing things. It will still be to the advantage of other people to trade with them. And we saw in the Law of Association why that's the case. So one way to look at what Mises is saying about how society is formed is this way. Imagine, as I've just done, we're thinking now, we can recognize that we wouldn't be in very good, we wouldn't get along very well at all if we were all by ourselves. We can see pretty easily what the advantages of the division of labor are. Even people who aren't familiar with the law of association will be able to grasp they wouldn't do very well if we had to produce things just on their own. They recognize that trade is beneficial to everybody, and so it's a very good idea to have society. Now, Mises takes a very commonsensical point of view. He says, well, people realize this today. People think that recognize the benefits of social cooperation. They realize it's in their self-interest to live in society rather than try to live on their own. So he thinks, well, isn't that it also reasonable that when people were forming society, they would also realize this. They didn't have as clear, before societies were formed, they didn't have as clear an understanding as we do today, but they did recognize the benefits of trade and exchange, even on a small scale, and it was from that that society developed. So Mises is taking a very commonsensical point of view. He said, here's the advantages we have today for living in society. So people at the start realize at least some of those same advantages. That's why they form society. And it's a very much an appeal to reason. Isn't it reasonable to think people would grasp this? It's not very hard to grasp that you benefit from trade So according to Mises, people will realize this. But now here we return to the point I mentioned at the start, the historical situation in which Mises was writing. People, or at least most people in Europe at the time Mises was writing, most of the professors that he had to contend with, didn't view matters at that time. And why not? Well, remember, Mises, at the time he was writing in the 30s and even earlier in the 1920s, throughout the 40s, there were fascism and communism were very prominent movements. And Mises, as a supporter of classical liberalism, viewed himself as fighting with these movements. And he saw this opposition between classical liberalism and, on the one hand, and fascism and communism on the other, as a battle between reason, or the forces of enlightenment, and irrationalism. So he's subsuming this battle between liberalism and its opposing social philosophies, such as fascism and communism, as part of a battle between reason and unreason. So he's giving this view of how society developed based on self-interest. He says this is a view that comes out of the Enlightenment, the movement in the 18th century of liberation from unsupported doctrines of tradition that weren't supported by reason. So he sees himself as very much in the tradition of the Enlightenment. And at the time he was writing, the theory on how society that originated with most popular was not this one, that society comes about because people recognize through reason the benefits of social cooperation, but rather they thought that society arises from some non-rational process. Malcolm asked a very good question having to do with social Darwinism and how this plays into this. Well, this is a topic we'll be getting to later in the lecture, so you're very right to think that social Darwinism comes into things. We'll see how it comes in a bit later. Okay, so the dominant account is not this one that Mises has, that society arises because people recognize the benefits of trade, social cooperation with division of labor, but that society arises from some non-rational process. And Mises, there are various accounts of non-rational process, but Mises calls all of them together the fable of the mystic communion. Remember, just as in the previous lecture, he says that he calls certain kinds of views theocratic, ones that say there's some outside source that gives us a clue to how history is going, calls those theocratic, even if they aren't religious in the ordinary language sense. Here, again, he's calling the fable of mystic communion, he's taking this in a very broad way, that any doctrine that says the way society originates is by some non-rational process counts as part of the fable of the mystic communion. Now, one example of this kind of mystical view that he's opposed is this, that says that people are in mystical union with God. So we can sense it, God is not just something, some sort of entity that some people believe in and some people don't, or some people have arguments that say they can show that God exists, other people don't accept those or have arguments to the contrary. This view is that people sense God. They have a direct sense of God. There was a book by the Scottish theologian John Bailey called The Sense of the Presence of God. This is an example of such a view, that we all sense God's presence. And cooperation in society, the reason people join together in society, is an aspect of this union with God. So we're all united in God, and then we come to realize we're all in part of the same body because we're all in this mystical union. Now, you might think it's not a view you're likely to find in your economics and sociology classes today, but it was a very popular view at the time Mises was writing. And we have to see as one of the underlying themes in human action. Mises isn't really explicit about this in the book, but this is what's on his mind. He wants to combat this view because one reason he wants to combat it is it stems, in at least to some degree, probably a great deal, from the person who was Mises' main enemy at the University of Vienna, who was a philosopher, an economist, sociologist, he was in a number of different fields, named Otmar Spahn. Have any of you heard of Otmar Spahn? He's not a household word anymore. Anybody read anything by him? Well, he was a very popular lecturer. He was a very devout Catholic, and he was a supporter of a kind of a clerical fascist government. He believed very much in this notion that we're all part of a mystical union, and society comes about in this way. He would always talk about the primacy of the whole or to the parts. I remember Friedrich Hayek, who studied with Spahn at the University of Vienna, said Spahn would draw diagrams on the board illustrating this kind of notion of how wholes were primary to the individual. And then when his back was turned to the blackboard, some of the students would make fun of him and his diagrams. But he was very, very popular. And one little complication here is that one of Spahn's main students was Erich Vogelin, the historian, philosopher of history, who had a view of society like this, that there were societies based on mystical union with God. But he was also a colleague of Mises. So he was trying to combine Spahn and Mises. So Mises perhaps is aiming a bit at him also. So again, what is this view? Again, it's that society doesn't originate because people, as Mises says, because people recognize rationally the benefits of social cooperation through the free market, but people are in a mystical union with God, and their being society is really an aspect of this mystical union. Now, how does Mises respond to this? Well, he does so in a way you might at first find a bit surprising. You might expect he would say, well, people, he might deny that people have such a feeling of union. He might say, he doesn't have it, or some people don't have it, but he doesn't do that. It's very characteristic of him. He tends, if he's replying to a theory, tends, rather than just say the theory's wrong, he'll try to say, even if we accepted the theory, it wouldn't show what the people who favor it intended to, or there's some way of undermining the theory. So he said, instead of saying, well, people don't have this feeling of mystical union with God, he said maybe they do have it, but those feelings arise only after people have formed a society. So they're not primary. So he says to Spahn, okay, you say people have these feelings of mystical union, maybe you're right, but that doesn't explain the basis of a society, because you only get this kind of mystical union with people once you're already in a society with them. So this wouldn't explain why you form a society in the first place. You have to have a society before you can get these feelings of mystical union. Now, there is a related theory to this. The voice, which I believe is called the voice of the blood. This is something you'll find not only in Europe, but you find in Germany, but you find in other countries. The novelist D.H. Lawrence talked about thinking with the blood. But this voice of the blood refers especially to a racial theory that was very popular among the Nazis. Remember, the Nazis were popular not just in Germany in the 1930s after Hitler, of course, had come to power January 30th, 1933. There was a very strong Nazi movement in Austria as well. So according to this theory, people of the same race hear a voice of the blood that impels them to get together. So if, say, you're a member of a certain ethnic group, say you're a German, you'll hear a voice from other Germans. You'll have a feeling that'll get you together with them. You might think, well, this sounds kind of pretty laughable, but the racial theorists mention, say, parents and children form very close bonds. So they said, just like there are ties of blood that bind parents and children, there are also ties of blood that bind people of the same race. So you see, this is a more materialistic version of this doctrine of fable of the mystic communion. So Spahn said, well, people get together because we're all have these feelings of mystical unity with God, and we recognize that we're having these feelings together, so we're part of the same organic body. This is a more materialistic view that people in the same race feel direct biological connections with other members of the race. So that's why society forms. If you're a German, you're in a society with other Germans because you have these biological feelings that have made you get together with them. And Mises' response here is similar to what he said about the other theory that we've just given. He says maybe people do have such feelings, but they arise after and not before people form a society. So it isn't that people have these feelings of the voice, they hear the voice of the blood, they say, oh well, here's this voice of the blood, it says I'd better get together with all these other Germans so we'll form a society. It's only after the society forms that you might have these feelings. And Mises goes on to make it, and we can see why is he so talking so much about this racial theory. It isn't a very popular theory today. You probably, if somebody gave this kind of racial theory in a university today, they'd probably kick them out for being politically incorrect. But again, remember, at the time Mises was writing, remember the Nazis were very powerful. They looked like for a while they were taking over Europe, and Mises was very concerned when he was writing in the 1930s and later to combat them. So, to say Mises raised a number of criticisms of this particular view. One is that the alleged voice of the blood doesn't operate in accord with racial theory. Because the racial theory said, well, all and the Germans will feel this voice of the blood. They'll all feel it, but they won't feel that same voice for other races. They aren't in the same blood as you are if you're in one race. A different race will be people of a different blood, so they'll have their own voice of the blood, but they'll be different from yours. So one thing Mises says is that the Germans include many people who've been Germanized only recently. There are cases they were Slavs that were became German. So after they were Slav, if you go back in their ancestry for a while, they would be Slavic, but then they just Germans in say one or two generations, and then they're included that. They're included also, they'd be included also in Germany. I mean, say people we think of as quintessentially German were had other backgrounds. Nietzsche was part Polish, although he was pretty proud of that, actually. So Mises says, well, Germans include many people who've been Germanized only recently, and then sometimes people don't feel this voice from people who are members of the same ethnic group. For example, Prussians and Bavarians are both German, but they didn't get along so well. So you can be antagonistic to other people in your racial group. And also, Mises thinks races are all mixed anyway. So at least when you talk about races, I think he means say branches of Europeans. He probably applied this to races more broadly concerned, but he has primarily in mind here by race other various subgroups of Europeans. So he said they're all mixed up, and you don't always feel the voice of a blood the way the theory says. And I see another point. Malcolm has another point. How Mises respond to recent neuroscience during 3 months old infants prefer faces that are similar to theirs. Well, I don't think he'd have any particular problem with that, because remember, he's not saying there's no such thing as fellow feeling for people of your own group, but he said you can't use that as an overarching explanation for society, because in the first place, these feelings come about only once a society is formed, and also the feelings people have don't always correspond to what they're supposed to in explaining society. People will be in different, people will not have feelings for different people in who they're supposed to have according to the theory, that they will have feelings for other people. So you can't really use this theory to account for society. But to remember, to refute a theory, you don't have to show there's absolutely nothing to it. So anytime you cut flat time, you say, oh, well, look, here's a mother and child who bond together. You can't say, okay, well, if you're against this racial theory, you have to show there are no such feelings as that. That would not be required at all. You just have to show that there are some problems with the theory. You don't have to show there are no biological bonds at all between people. Now, there's another theory which is related to the voice of the blood theory, and this would be probably a more popular one today, that people have a biological instinct to form societies. So if you say, why do people get together in societies? Well, it's just people, according to this view, people just have an instinct to form society. It's just it's just what we do, just like some animals will get together in herds. People have a biological instinct to form societies. And in support of this, isn't it pretty clear that the mutual attraction of the sexes is biological? Say if you see someone you're attracted to, that's pretty basic. That isn't something that we have to learn or reason out. It's you just get the feelings right away. So isn't this at least some evidence that there is such a thing as mutual attraction among people that's biologically based? So again, Mises doesn't deny this. Remember, he's not denying basic facts of biology, like some people are attracted to other people. But he says okay, you could explain why, say, people get together for sexual purposes, but that doesn't explain his view that families or larger groups, such as a society, because those aren't biologically necessary. He said we don't have to live in families or in larger groups. It isn't that biology compels us to do that. We could have people just getting together, say, just for sex or procreation, just occasionally, and living relatively isolated. That would be quite consistent with biology. But so we don't have to have families and larger groups because of biology. It, again, Mises reiterates his view that society stems from a reasoned recognition of its advantages. So once again, you have, on the one hand, here are these irrationalist views, these appeal to instinct or mystical feeling. On the one hand, that Mises associates with fascist or communist views, and then he has his own view, which is associated with classical liberalism, is that society stems from reason. There's nothing, it isn't that we're driven by these voices of the blood or by instinct or mystical feelings of communion. Not that we can't have such feelings or hear such voices, but what's primary is that people recognize the advantages of getting together in society, and that explains why they do so. Oops. Now, the view I've been mentioning before is that Mises is opposed to is that one of the views is that society arises because of biological instinct, or people are driven biologically to get together in society. And as we see, Mises doesn't accept that. He doesn't accept that people hear a voice of the blood that tell them they should get together with certain people. But he also rejects, we can see kind of an inverse of that view, which is held by some of the same people, is that antagonisms between certain racial groups are biologically innate also. So, say, some people said, well, all the Germans are hear the voice of the blood tongue to get together. So another view, which was many people who held that view held this also, was that there's a long-seated biological antagonism between the Teutonic peoples and the Slavic peoples. You'll find both, there's both German and Slavic thinkers held that there's kind of a, they're two different racial souls. That was a popular view, and they're in opposition to each other. And Mises doesn't accept that either. And he points out, well, there's a lot of evidence of racial mixtures between these antagonistic groups. So the antagonism, at any rate, can't be total because the groups have gotten together. They've interbred and have racial mixtures. So it can't be that you regard, if you're involved in such a mix, you can't regard the other person with total hostility. So again, Mises appeals to a very commonsensical point of view to reject this theory. There's an innate hostility between different racial groups. Now he makes what I consider, that's a very commonsensical point, but he makes what I consider also a more profound point. He says, again, remember, he follows the same strategy we've seen before, where he won't say there's nothing to these feelings, but he says even if you did have the feelings, they wouldn't explain what they're supposed to do. So remember, he said, well, maybe people do have feelings of mystical communion, but that doesn't explain why society arises. We have to have a society first before we have the feelings of mystical communion. Or similarly, we don't hear the voice of the blood from people unless we're already in a society with them. So here he said, well, okay, supposing there are these feelings of hostility between different groups. He says that won't prevent the society composed of the hostile groups from arising. And why wouldn't it? And remember, we should know the answer from last week. Remember, we talked about the law of association, which says that trade in division of labor is beneficial even if one person or group is inferior in everything that it produces to the other group. Trade is still beneficial for everybody because it will, you might think, well, of course it's beneficial for the group that isn't so good at producing things, as long as that it's trading with that group will be trading with people who are better at producing things than it is. But it's better for the superior group to specialize in what it's best at rather than produce everything for itself. So the basic point here is, Mises is saying, it doesn't matter if people don't like each other as long as they can recognize the benefits of trade and association with each other, division of labor, they can form a society. So this is what he says to that. On this notion of feelings of hostility, it reminds me of a story I read recently about the economist Armin Alchi, who taught at UCLA, who was a very good free market economist who died a short time ago. He was 98 years old. So one of his students told this story about him, Walter Williams. You may know the economist students. He's a PhD student at UCLA. So he said to Alchi, and he said, well, he said, my wife has the attitude that she thinks people, when she meets new people, she thinks they'll like her, so she likes them unless their evidence turns out that they don't. And Walter Williams said, well, his attitude was, he thinks most people won't like him, so he won't like them unless the evidence turns out otherwise. So Alchin said to him, well, I think you're overlooking the third possibility, which is most people don't give a damn about you. So I think this is what really, that story is pretty much what Mises is saying. It doesn't really matter what other people think about you, even if they don't like you, you can still get into a society with them. Now, oh, I wonder who that was. It was probably someone trying to disrupt my lecture. We can't allow that. Okay, now, what we've been talking about so far is how people form societies. I've said repeatedly, according to Mises, the basic point is that people recognize the advantages of getting together in an organized way because then they'll benefit from division of labor and trade with each other. But once people form a society, not every type of interaction they engage in counts as social. And one example that doesn't, according to Mises, is a war of annihilation. Let's say you're in a group and you're going to say, well, we're going to destroy everybody in the other group. That wouldn't count as a type of social interaction. You'd just be saying, let's get rid of everybody else. So that isn't a social relationship with them. However, it doesn't follow from that war is not a way of social, not a type of social interaction, because Mises points out many wars are not wars of annihilation. Why not? But why don't people just say, okay, we're in one group, we don't like this other group, so we're just going to get rid of them. And the reason is people recognize that after war cooperation with the people they're fighting will be useful. So they have rules of warfare that say they would limit what can be done in warfare. So supposing, say, you're looking, let's look at Europe in the 19th century, say you have Germany was unified in three wars, 1864 against Denmark, 1866 against Austria, and 1870-71 against France, but Germany didn't try to get Germany didn't try to get rid of all these countries, and Prussia, it wasn't Germany, didn't form really till the last war, but the Prussians didn't try to get rid of these other countries. As they recognized, they had particular goals in mind that they thought could best be achieved by violence, but they still wanted to be related to these groups, these other people afterwards. So they follow a strict set of rules that limit what they can do. For example, civilians can't be directly attacked, or certain weapons are forbidden. So these rules have a very, they're formed kind of a code, and they really, even though you think if you're at war with somebody, you're not in a social relationship, Mises said that's true only if it's a war of annihilation. If you follow certain rules, then that would still be a social relationship because you're using violence, but you're still intending to cooperate with the people, at least afterwards, or to some extent even during the war. There are wars, actually, you know, in 17th and 18th century, say, where people continued trading with the enemy, where, say, people were had a city under siege, and then they would sell provisions to the city while they have a city under siege. And the groups that accept these limited rules form what Mises calls a great society. So the term great society is associated probably today with the programs of Lyndon Johnson. Of course, Mises didn't mean that. He means the groups that accept this overarching code of behavior that limits what they can do even in war. And I see there's a question here from Colin, what about violent crime? Yes, I think violent crime, we could make kind of a parallel point there. It isn't in itself social, but it could be that criminals recognize certain limits on what they do, and it's to the extent they do, then they would still be part of society. But the purely destructive aspects of what they do would not be social. Now, another, getting back to a similar point to what Mises said about society, where we talk about biological theories of society, there are also biological theories of war and destruction. There are some people who say human beings have an instinct for aggression and destruction. And according to a philosophy that was very popular at the time Mises was writing, I think it's pretty clear he has Nietzsche in mind as one of the writers, is that the view would be civilization weakens us, and what we really have is we have these animal values, say we should assert ourselves and try to advance ourselves aggressively. We should always try to strengthen the will to power and struggle with other people. But civilization weakens us. It's really the triumph of the values of the weak. The weak have convinced the aristocrats wrongly that aggression is bad, and that made them subscribe to some kind of moral restraint, but those restraints don't express our real nature. They're a way of weakening us. It's the kind of triumph of the weak, and what's called for is a transvaluation of values in which the values of assertion and aggression would come to the fore. Whether this is a correct understanding of Nietzsche is a disputed matter, but many people at any rate took him that way, and we find this view in many other writers as well. Mises, I'm sure, had in mind when he was writing here. Could you hold on? I'll be right back. I just want to check this. One sec, please.
I'm sorry, I'm getting a lecture now. I can't move this. I can't come up right now.
Sorry about that. It was an insurance salesman. I shouldn't have answered it. You answer your phone. I mean, if this isn't going to arouse the instinct for aggression and destruction, I don't know what will. I mean, clearly insurance salesmen aren't part of society. Now, Malcolm says, prior to the 20th century, were there any agreements on the prohibition of certain weapons in warfare? Not able to find any. Oh, the notion of limit, I mean, you should look at a book by F.J.P. Veal, Advance to Barbarism. It gives a good account of the limits on war in the 18th, 19th century. I mean, the 20th century is much more unlimited war than the 18th and 19th. I mean, it's not that limits on war come in or a new thing, it's the limits were more the older way. So, as I say, Nietzsche is one of the writers Mises has in mind here is holding this view that civilization is weakening us. Another is Georges Sorel. Have any of you read Sorel? He's a very interesting writer called Reflections on Violence. He thought that people had emphasized the intellect too much, and what was needed was kind of a redeeming myth. He favored the myth of the general strike, something like the labor movement would have this view that if it just stopped working, everything, the whole economy would collapse, and they would organize themselves around this to take action. Even if they couldn't find a rational basis for the general strike, that didn't matter. It would just be they ought to emphasize this because this would keep them going. Slide didn't move. One second. Okay, now, Mises is, well, you expect now, his response is not to say, well, there isn't any instinct to aggression or violence. Just as we've seen his response to these other theories is not to say, well, there's no such thing as a feeling of mystical communion or the voice of the blood or feelings of racial antagonism to other people. He doesn't deny those feelings, but he just says they don't explain what the people who favor them say they will. Oh, excuse me, one more. Sorry, why don't we...
Hello? Oh, hi, Louis, how are you? Could I call you back? I'm just giving my lecture now. Oh, okay, thanks, Louis. Thanks. Bye.
That one was the Commander-in-Chief, Lou Rockwell. So that one, that's all right. Good thing I answered. That was our Supreme Commander. Okay. Sorry for those interruptions. As I say, Mises' response is not to deny that there's a tendency to violence, that people have an aggressive instinct, but he says, well, what's wrong with this theory that says civilization is really making us weak and weakening our natural tendency? He says, well, the tendency to violence, if it exists, is no more a product of evolution than the tendency to cooperate. Because social cooperation is the way human beings survive. After all, human beings aren't the strongest animal in the world or the fastest, but we're able to survive against other animals because we can cooperate. We can have tools and weapons that they can't have, so we're able to defeat them. I mean, a lion would easily defeat a human being in combat, but people can form societies and take protective measures against lions, or need be shoot them or hunt them. So the fact that we have the social, we have instincts, we have a tendency to cooperate, that's equally biological to whatever tendency to violence we have. But also, and this is again an extremely important point about the way Mises is thinking, he says, suppose people do have such an aggressive instinct as these various biological writers were supposing, it doesn't follow they're bound to act on it. Supposing, say, someone really annoys me, I'd really like to punch this person in the nose, I really hate this person. It doesn't follow because I have that feeling, I'm going to act on it. I can recognize, well, it's going to have very bad consequences for me. Say if I punch this person in the nose, he might hit me back, and in almost all cases, he'll win the fight, or if I hit him, maybe I'll be arrested and go to jail. So if I have feelings of various kinds, whether aggressive or any other kind of feeling, I can decide which feeling to act on. So one of the basic characteristics of human beings is that they can decide on which of their feelings that they want to act on. They don't have to say, well, okay, I got this feeling, so that's going to make me do a certain thing regardless of anything else. And this is Mises' basic response to the instinct theory. He says, look, people might have instincts of various kinds, but we don't act on them automatically. We can examine the various instincts that we have that are pressuring us to do a certain thing and decide whether we want to do it. Now, one question that arises here is Mises saying here that we shouldn't act on the instinct for aggression and destruction? He certainly seems hostile to this view, say when he's talking about this view that civilization is just kind of an effete cover-up that's preventing us from exercising our instincts of violence. He obviously isn't very sympathetic to that view. He certainly doesn't like Sorel, and he isn't agreeing. He thinks Nietzsche's all wrong in what he says about the transvaluation of value. So his Mises is really saying, look, we should, in quotation marks, act rationally rather than just let go and exercise our instincts for aggression and destruction. So what Mises says, remember this is the point we covered to some extent in the last lecture, is Mises denies he's doing this. He says he isn't just giving, he isn't giving a value judgment, something like, I don't like aggression and destruction. I prefer cooperation. So somebody could say to him, well, okay, this is what you prefer, but what if I prefer something else? Maybe he's just showing he has different value judgments from those of Nietzsche or Sorel or other writers who like violence more than he does. Mises says, no, this isn't what he's doing. What he's doing is pointing out the consequences of acting on our instincts for aggression and destruction. And he says most people will find these consequences undesirable. So he's saying, again, this is not a value judgment. He's saying if you act aggressively toward others instead of cooperating with them, then you'll be depriving yourselves of the benefits of social cooperation through the free market. You won't be able to have civilization if you do that. And so he's saying most people, if when they realize this, will find that undesirable. They'll say, okay, that isn't a good bargain. It isn't worth it to me to be aggressive and destructive. That's what the result is. But Mises isn't giving a value judgment saying, look, people like Nietzsche prefer aggression, but I don't. I prefer peace. He's saying, if you act on these aggressive impulses, then this is what's going to happen. You'll be destroying civilization. And that, again, is not a value judgment. It's a statement of what will happen. It's a descriptive statement. Now, Mises goes on to make some remarks, and this is where the point about social Darwinism comes in that Malcolm was asking for earlier. Some people attack the political program of classical liberalism because classical liberalism says that everybody has equal rights. Say everybody has a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Declaration of Independence. Or if you take the Rothbardian view, everyone is a self-owner. So according to people who attack classical liberalism from a biological basis, they say people aren't equal. We know this from biology. People are very different in ability. Some people are stronger than others. The social Darwinist says, well, the strong should not respect the weak, but take advantage of them. So isn't the notion of classical liberalism based on equality inherently counter to biology that's showing that people are very different in ability? And Mises' response here is that he's not at all assuming that people have equal natural rights. He does favor a legal system which people have equal rights. We're not doing this on the basis of some kind of philosophy that says people have equal rights. His argument is utilitarian. He said we'll all be better off in a society where we cooperate and accord equal rights to each other. But this is not in contradiction at all with biology. It doesn't, because it isn't making a statement about whether people are unequal or equal. It's just saying people are going to be better off under this classical liberal system than under its rivals. And I think we can make a further point. We ask, what is the right? If you say, I have a right to certain property, it's right to limit what people ought morally to have. For example, if I'm a self-owner, it means I ought to make certain decisions about in connection with my body. If somebody needs a blood transplant from blood donation from me, I ought to be the one to decide who, whether I want to give that or not, not the person who wants the blood. So the doctrine of rights is the same of what people ought morally to have. It isn't a descriptive claim about human properties, so there's no contradiction at all there between biology and rights. Somebody could say, well, but the rights ought to be based on the biological differences between people. That wouldn't follow from the biology. That would be a particular view, which of course classical liberalism wouldn't accept. And I see Travis says, although we're classical liberalism based on equality before the law, on equality in material possessions, that's a pretty good point. And again, and he says, although we're not created equal, we're created with equal rights, life, and property. Yes, that's exactly right. That is the classical liberal view. Okay, well, I think we'll end the lecture here now, and we can have the rest of the time for questions and objections and so on. So, anything you like. Don't all run to be the first one. Oh, now here's something. What is that? Malcolm says, let me see if you have some quotations here. Now, would you say that German thought has had a proportionally larger influence on the world philosophically rather than economic, or both? Or go and say philosophy influenced economics. We want to compare the size of the colonial kingdom compared to that of England. Why has German thought had such a disproportionate influence throughout history? That's an interesting question. You know, if you, Heidegger in his book Introduction to Metaphysics says that the reason German thought has been influential philosophically, he says German and Greek are the main philosophical languages. So in his view, German is peculiarly suited to express certain philosophical concepts. That isn't the view I'd agree with, but I would say more it's that particular German thinkers such as Kant and Hegel have had a lot of influence. I don't think there's anything inherently Germanic about it. It's just particular thinkers from that area were very influential. But I wouldn't have any theory of national characteristics to account for it. I think it's just a matter of particular people being influential. I mean, one could say perhaps that because of the lack of unity compared to lack of political unity in the German states, you know, Germany became a unified country only in 1870 to 71. There was more of an emphasis on thought than in other countries. You know, they call Germany the land of thinkers and poets. But then, of course, when they became a nation, they showed they were quite capable of less thoughtful and less poetic activities as well. But I think, you know, other countries, of course, have had, I don't think you could tie philosophy exclusively to Germany, though. Okay. Here's something else. Wait a sec here. Now, Malcolm has a question about Max Stirner. Guess what? Stirner tends to view that the individual should concentrate only on himself. But he didn't deny the existence of collectives, but he said that individuals should concentrate just on themselves. So he was an egotist in a kind of a stronger sense than Ayn Rand. He thought that really, in some sense, the world exists for each individual separately. He tended to attack collectives. He didn't deny his abstractions were kind of sucking the lifeblood out of individuals. James J. Martin thinks very highly of Stirner. I met people who were Stirnerites, but I think we have to be made of Stirner stuff and stick to Mises. Now, Malcolm says, what did Mises think of Ayn Rand? Well, she came to, I think, a couple times to his seminar, and he thought highly of her as a novelist. I don't think he made any close study of her philosophical work. I mean, I think he liked the fact that she'd written a novel defending private business, and he had a letter to her where he said she's recognized the importance of the elite in history. Now, she had views on him. She had notes on human action where she liked his economics, but she thought he was too much influenced by Kantian philosophy, and she had criticisms of particular formulations of his in human action. And John says, what is meant by right to property? Well, I mean, it would be a claim that, say, you ought to have control over decisions regarding your body. If you have a right to certain property, you ought to be the one making the decisions about that property. So if, say, you have a right to certain property, then, say, the government shouldn't take it away from you, not just because it won't have good consequences. Maybe if the government takes away your property, then maybe you won't be interested in producing as much. But if you have a right to it, then it would just be wrong for the government to do that. It would be you have ought morally to decide what should be done with that property. But did you have a particular difficulty in mind in the phrase that you think there's some problem with right to property? I mean, I think we just mean by rights in a very conventional sense that you have the moral power to decide what's to be done with the property. Now, Kant said, did Rand reject pre-Mises' Austrian subjective value theory? Not fully. I think she didn't like calling value subjective. She preferred just saying she didn't like the word subjective. I don't think she had a counter theory of economics of her own, different theory of value. They just didn't like the word subjective. Now, John says, the difficulty he had in mind was who would grant ownership to physical property. Well, I mean, that would depend on what theory you had. Say, on the Rothbard's homesteading view, people would start off as self-owner, and then the land is unowned, so people mix their labor with it in the appropriate way, and then they get it. So it isn't granted by anyone. It's just you have a right to acquire property under certain conditions. Now, John Galt says that Mises believed in natural rights. No, no, he didn't. He was a utilitarian. He thought that rights should be part of a legal system, but they aren't natural. That they are. It isn't that the rights exist apart from a legal system. Okay, now we have some other ones here. How would you argue against Mises' social rationalist approach? Well, I mean, I think if somebody wanted to do that, I guess they would try to claim that the people didn't recognize the advantages of social cooperation, trade to the extent Mises thought they did, or they might stress, they might say society arose not through some conscious process. They would basically just give a different theory and try to come up with arguments for that. But remember, of course, Mises has considered a lot of these other theories and has given reasons why he prefers his. Now, Travis says, I have a complex question which I'm presenting to some other think tanks. Oh, we have to watch out, complex questions. Here's a state of nature. How could an individual entrepreneur capitalist start an enterprise or hire any with no capital to begin with? How could an entrepreneur capitalist earn profit to employ his division of labor and must possess profit in the first place and prior to the commencement of his enterprise and employment of workers? That is, in the original state of nature, how could any one person get any more capital than any other person to employ him and others in the first place? We're all born properly, excluding those who inherit the accumulation of capital from previous generations. I agree with George Reisman that wages are a deduction from profits and that profits must come first before enterprise commence. Just curious what Mises would say. Well, that's not a complex question. It's more of a treatise. But I think maybe I'm underestimating the complexity of your question. I mean, I would think, say, if it's true, say you imagine individuals don't have anything, they would just try to make things by themselves and then not consume everything they made. So if they did that, then they'd build up a capital reserve that they could use to hire others. I'm not seeing why that's supposed to be so difficult. It's something like, suppose I'm growing apples by myself, but I don't eat all the apples, I just save some and store them, then I can use those apples maybe to hire other people to do things that I want. I think that would probably be how it would get started. Now, Collins has a Rand's criticism. Mises to use the word subjective. That was one of the criticisms. Yes, I mean, she also basically criticized, she thought he had a wrong view of concepts. Mises talks about a priori concepts, and she doesn't believe in any a priori concepts. She thinks all concepts come from experience. And Garson, she criticized the utilitarian ethics. Yes, that's right. And she has her own view of ethics based on her notion of ethical egoism. Now, Travis says, though, society is something like individualist anarchy, which leads to free market capitalism. How capitalism, that's one is a political system, the other is an economic system. You could certainly have capitalism arising in a non-anarchist society. I mean, I don't see what the connection is. There that you're drawing. I mean, maybe you're thinking, oh, because I said individuals could acquire, you asked the question, how would individuals acquire property? If we start out properly, and I said individuals would save them up, maybe you're thinking we have to be in an anarchist society to do that, but I don't think that would be true. It just whatever the political system was, they just have to save things up, provided the society allowed them to do that. Now, Malcolm said, in the sign reading Rothbard wrote, I very much like to know what you, Dr. Harper, think of the problem. Should individuals be humane or rugged? Do we know what Dr. Harper's response to this question was? Why was Fee looking to distribute Dr. Cutten's speech? Was this one of the philosophical schisms that led Rothbard splitting from Fee, the difference between rugged and humane individuals? Well, no, I think Harper was not a proponent of social Darwinism in the sense that Cutten was, or one of struggle. In fact, he stressed very much the way Rothbard did, the peaceful relations between people. So there wouldn't be, I think, any basic difference between Rothbard and Harper there. It wasn't responsible for Rothbard splitting from, Rothbard really didn't split from Fee, just didn't work with them as much, but Harper had actually split from, was the one who split from Fee and started his own group. And your question, I don't know why Fee was trying to distribute this speech. It was just, I suppose it was, they thought, well, here's someone who's favoring business, and they weren't necessarily committing themselves to particular views, philosophical views he had, but they thought, oh, well, isn't this nice? Someone saying some good things about business, but it wasn't basically the way either Rothbard or Harper argued. Now, Collins said, Rand used a priori in some sense, is it different than the way Mises uses it? Well, I don't think Rand liked to speak of a priori at all. I'd be interested, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think she didn't believe in a priori propositions. She thought everything came from experience. So if she did use it in a favorable way, it would be different from the way Mises did, but I don't think she did, actually. Oh, here's what, now the question Malcolm is asking is, would it be, when would you rationally choose collectivism? Now, it's not, that's not a question Rothbard wrote much about. Now, he did sometimes, when he talked about foreign policy, he didn't accept the slogan that some of the Cold Warriors had, better dead than red. So I think he might think, if your only choice to survive would be to accept the collectivist regime, that would probably be a reason to do it, but it's not a question he ever said all that much about. Oh, here's one, another question here. Let me see another quotation here. Now, Now, Malcolm asked an interesting question. He said Rothbard contrasts forced charity through the government versus individual charity. Did he write a lot about that? Now, he has some discussion in Power and Market of, I think, of charity and ethics of liberty. He didn't write a lot about it. And then Malcolm raised an interesting point. What about societies where you weren't forced to contribute, there was kind of strong peer pressure to do so, it was kind of it's the accepted thing that you should contribute. Maybe you'd be ill thought of or ostracized if you didn't. Well, that's an actually very fundamental question. You see, in Rothbard's approach to libertarianism, he very strongly differentiated between coercion, which means the threat, the use or threat of force, physical force, and anything else. So peer pressure would not be anti-libertarian to contribute charity. Whether it's a good thing or not would be another matter, but that would be perfectly consistent with a Rothbardian society, say, supposing you would just not be well thought of if you gave nothing to charity. That would be perfectly all right in libertarian matters, from a libertarian standpoint, at least according to Rothbard. Now, couldn't that shunning lead to a state? Well, I don't think it would have to. I mean, it would just be people wouldn't associate socially with certain others. You wouldn't have to have it. You wouldn't have to have a state to kick them out. I don't see why. Now, here's another question. Rand talks about axiomatic but not a priori. Is she using a different term? Is axiomatic different from means a priori? Yes. As you see, axiom, what she calls a primary, is something that's, something derived from experience, but is you're sort of a starting point, but you're getting it from experience. Like there's no further argument for it. Like I think she takes existence exists as axiomatic, secures something out there. The mind is directed toward something outside the mind. That's fundamental. But she doesn't think that something apart from experience. She thinks that's directly given to us in experience. So that's what's different. See, Mead is that we have to have certain concepts in order to understand experience, and these concepts aren't derived from experience. But Rand says, no, there aren't any concepts that don't come from experience. So that's why axiomatic is different from a priori. That axiomatic is something that's based on experience. Now, Leslie says that he thinks Mises and Nietzsche held similar views of the state, which Nietzsche called cold monsters. Nietzsche saw morality as an instrument for the priestly caste to maintain control of society. Seems to me similar to Rothbard's view of state elites and ideology. Maybe in his total rejection of all values, Nietzsche threw out morality, maybe with a priestly class bathwater. That's a very interesting way of looking at it. I mean, Rothbard does not think that all morality stems from the elites and ideology, but Nietzsche does kind of view morality as kind of an imposition of this originally weak group on the strong. So I think you're quite right in what you suggest there. That's a very good point. Now, Travis says, philosophers always talk about the original state of nature, which was the premise of my question. How society functions on an economic level prior to the existence of a state. I see. I think there you just have to look at anthropology. I think people I think most anthropologists now think people lived in small groups before there was an organized state. So I think that would be how it would function. But you wouldn't have to assume, just because people talk about a state of nature, that there was some state time when people existed without a government, although I think anthropologists seem to think that now. But I mean, that would just be an empirical question. It wouldn't follow just from the notion of the state of nature that the government came later. I think probably did, but that would just be something that would comes about empirically. Another one from Travis. Noam Chomsky said the Rothbard, anarchy will be full of hatred where people demand others to pay use roads and the like, which you deem should be communal and even not private ones. How would anarcho-capitalist respond to Noam Chomsky's claim that hatred would be everywhere in anarcho-capitalist society? Well, I mean, why would we think that? I mean, just like, say, with businesses today, the business people don't hate their customers. They want people to buy from them. So why would we think that people were selling rights to use roads would hate other people? They probably want to design the roads in such a way they would attract people to use their services. I mean, I don't think Chomsky understands the free market very well at all. I mean, I'm not sure. Wouldn't we have hatred more under a system where the government is taking things from certain groups and giving them to others? Now, here's one from John Galt. Why can mixed economy exist if social rationalism is guiding everything? Mises isn't assuming social rationalism guides everything. He thinks people get together in societies because they recognize the benefits of trade and cooperation through the division of labor. But unfortunately, people are under the sway of mistaken ideas also, and it's certain interest groups. It's in their interest to interfere with the free market in various ways, so those people promote those kinds of interference. But when Mises, I think your question is a very good one, because when we say Mises is a social rationalist, it doesn't mean that he thinks everything in society is based on reason and we'd all be living in a complete free market. He just thinks that people, at least to some extent, operate on rational perception of their own interests, but certainly not making that universally true. That's a very good question you ask. Chomsky thinks long thin things should not be privately owned. Probably thinks most things shouldn't be. Yeah, and John Galt said not everyone is rational, or not everyone is always rational. Now, Malcolm said, reading Salerno's introduction to history of banking, Salerno speaks of Mises' contribution to the study of history. What did Mises ensure that was unique in the study of history? How is his methodology unique from what came before? Has anyone contributed further after Mises' theory in history? Has anyone furthered the studies of methodology? Has anyone advanced Mises' etymology? Mises wasn't the only one who wrote about the method in studying history where you have kind of specific understanding, where you reconstruct the thoughts of the historical actors you're trying to account for. I mean, I don't think he was unique, but he developed this in a very interesting way in theory and history and used it to criticize Marxism and other forms of history. There are other people who write in a similar way. I don't think anyone's really had any major theoretical advances after him, but I mean, Mises was one of the people in this tradition, which included Wilhelm Dilthey, Heinrich Rickert, R.G. Collingwood, Benedetto Croce. There are a whole group of European thinkers who had similar views. So Mises was one of them. Now, Travis, I agree. Just one response to give to my libertarian socialist friends. Thank you. Now, Collins really thinks human action is indeed rational, and Travis said all human action has purpose. That's a very good point. You see, when Mises says all human actions rational, it means every action uses means to achieve ends, and it will use the action will use the means that he thinks will enable him to achieve his end. But when we talk about people perceiving their rational self-interest, they're using rational here in a different sense, where it has stricter requirements, something like a correct or reasonable understanding of what they're doing. And Mises does not think everyone is rational in that way. He thinks people do have some perception of what's in their self-interest, but he's not having the view that everyone always correctly perceives what's in his self-interest. But the sense in which people action is rational is that people use a means that they think will enable them to attain whatever ends they want. Now Malcolm says, regarding the argument Mises as social rational, did Rothbard agree or disagree with why monogamous marriage developed due to division of labor and property rights? Did Rothbard require the institution of marriage monogamy anywhere? If so, where? I don't believe he did. I know Hans Hoppe, I think, has written on that, but Rothbard did not. I mean, I think I don't know of any place where Rothbard addressed that question. And what is Hoppe's view? Well, I think that one he gives in his new book, if I'm not mistaken, I may have his view wrong, I think he thinks his view is quite similar to Mises, that he thinks monogamy wasn't the original state of things, that it arose similarly. Now, Leslie says, is a course on theory and history possible? I think Salerno mentioned this is a work that Mises worthy of more study. Yes, Hayek thought very highly of theory and history. Also, he told me that himself. Well, I mean, that would certainly be something to consider. I could, if people would like a course on that, that would be certainly one we could try to arrange if people wanted it. Okay, well, I guess we're out of time now. So thanks very much for coming to lecture. Sorry that I was a bit hectic. I had lunch with someone. I had to come back and start lecturing very fast. So I hope I wasn't more terrible than usual. So thanks, everybody. Hope we'll see. Now, next week, remember, it's the usual time, not Tuesday, not Wednesday for next week. Okay, thanks a lot, everybody. Bye.